This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, Of Their Time, the changing faces of diversity and prejudice in speculative fiction.
Now, this episode was suggested by Jules, but has been inspired by some recent events.
I think it's more the culmination of various different things. So we will go into it a little bit more in more detail later because there's quite a lot to unpack. But it was the reaction to Disney's casting of a black actress as the Little Mermaid in the new live-action Disney film.
Yes.
So we won't touch on that now. We'll come back to it in a minute. But I just feel like it's worth looking back, especially at books, but also at films, at how far we've all come. And that's not to say that there isn't still a long way to go, because there is. But I think sometimes we could all do with maybe just chilling out a little bit. If you see a major backsliding step, then yeah, definitely call it out. But that there's, I don't know, I think people come in angry about things in books and films and TV series, and there's no real focus for that anger, and they're just a fire hose, and they're spraying it on everybody. I can kind of get that, because everybody's, you know, entitled to their own personal anger. But there are times when what you're actually doing is you're attacking innocent bystanders. And that goes across the board for everybody, for anyone who's got, you know, whatever your main mission is. At some point or another, you've probably aimed how you feel your anger in the wrong direction. I know I have, and I'm pretty damn sure everybody else has as well. So that's roughly where I'm coming from, at least.
No, I agree with you. For the most part, I think the movement towards better representation has been fueled by, I'm going to say extremism, but it's not extremism. But I think that radical change kind of does demand sort of radical pushing, because if you don't, you know, rather than give an inch, take a mile, it's give a mile so that they will move an inch, you know? Create a lot of noise so that they will hear you just a little bit. So I can kind of understand why people are so forceful. And I'm not just talking about on the one side, I'm not just talking about people being forceful about representation. I'm also talking about people being forceful against it as well. And it kind of retrospective in that the one side has influenced the loudness of the other side, and now everybody is just shouting.
I think that's the problem. I'm all for, you know, let's all speak up. Let's call bullshit on things that are bullshit. But the problem is you need to make the right sort of noise, because after a certain point, I mean, you can hold a note forever, and then at some certain point it stops being a note in a song and just becomes meaningless noise. And it's kind of the same with this as well. You know.
And I also think that there are some things which are worth making a large amount of noise over, and there are some things which aren't. And unfortunately, there are some people who kind of make noise about not the wrong thing, but there you can see examples whereby they have excluded things which actually kind of do matter in favour of things which are less important.
But anyway, we'll come to that. Yeah, we'll get to all that in a moment. Let's go back to, I don't know, it's probably towards the end of the 1800s, early 1900s, and just have a look, because some of these books are absolute, they're considered absolute classics, whether you like them or not. What they did was they added something to the English language canon that hadn't been seen before. There are terrible, terrible books like Pamela, for example, which is almost rape culture personified, but written in the 1700s. And it's a, you know, it's an awful, awful book. But it's in the English canon because it hadn't really been done before. We're not going back quite that far. But the ones I hear that people seem to have an issue with good reason, are things like, okay, let's take Huckleberry Finn. I will say that I don't have a horse in that race. I don't especially like it. I don't especially dislike it. It's got a few clever bits. I can completely understand why people would feel that they want a certain character renamed. Because say you are sitting in a classroom and you're studying Huckleberry Finn, perhaps if, as a person of colour, you don't want to be sat there and hearing every passage where Huckleberry Finn and his best friend, you don't want to hear his name said every time because his name is a pejorative term.
Yes.
I don't think there's any point expunging the record entirely, so there's no point like making it completely PC and then getting rid of all the originals. I think you need that as an important document of social history. But at the same time, I can completely understand being in the class and saying, you know what? This reads exactly the same if we remove that pejorative term. So perhaps we just will remove that pejorative term. That's fine. Yeah.
I also can completely understand sitting in the classroom and saying, yes, this is an important piece of work, but why is it that we only ever study pieces of work like this? When there is actually a wealth of different kind of literature which has been excluded, which could be just as important in terms of studying the culture and the times, and also kind of the history of literature as well. I think it's naive to say that books like Huckleberry Finn or To Kill a Mockingbird or things like that, now less To Kill a Mockingbird because it's actually against, it's a conversation about racism, but also books which contain casual racism, they are probably quite important in terms of their place in literature, in terms of their popularity, in terms of understanding the time and the period and the whole direction that we've gone in. So we shouldn't just say, no, they're cancelled, as it were. We're not allowed to look at them. We must look at them with a pinch of salt. You know, as you were saying, Jules, it's about kind of understanding this is not, these things are not acceptable, but we have to understand the context. We have to apply context. But at the same time, we also have to question our schools and say, why are these things given so much priority over a wealth of other, often very underrepresented writers of the same period?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a complete myth that there were no black writers, that there were no Asian writers, that there were no female writers, and that every piece of literature that's worth studying was either by some complete outlier, or who managed to get famous enough that they were remembered, or it was by, you know, a white man of a certain background, or even a white man of a working class background who somehow bucked the odds and managed to get published. And it's just not, and you really need, in order to appreciate sort of the history of literature and by extension speculative fiction, to be able to look at a broad spectrum of different writers. And it's been a long time since I was in school, in fairness. Perhaps it's being done slightly differently. But as an example, I was sent to an all-girls school, as I've mentioned before. One of our exam texts was The Lord of the Flies by William Golding. I'm not going to dispute that that is... I'm not going to dispute that it is an interesting and clever piece of work. It really is. Its premise is war is the human condition, and that we are all, in some respects, we're not very far removed under our modern veneers from needing violence in order to sort of, I suppose, cohabit together in order to find our place in the world and universe. And, you know, there's some nasty stuff that obviously happens in Lord of the Flies.
Yeah.
But there was probably other selections that a class full of an entirely female class could have studied a book that wasn't made up of entirely male characters as a suggestion.
Well, I mean, the thing that always gets me with Lord of the Flies is that it is usually kind of taken out of context, which is that, as you say, it is about the human condition. But it kind of was written in anger by a private school teacher who was writing about the kind of private school boys taught.
Yeah.
Who were going to be the next leaders of the country. And here's the weird thing. They are still the leaders of the country. There is a disproportionate number of people who are currently in our, who run our country, who are private school boys. Like, it's a straight path. And it was about them. It was about saying these boys who are, you know, are meant to be the face of sophistication, of intelligence, who are meant to be the leaders of the country. If you put them in this situation, this is what they will turn into. Because they are actually have been competing and they've been competitive from a very, very young age. That was their background. In fact, I read this article very recently about the psychological effects of going to boarding school from an incredibly young age, particularly in all boys schools. So I think what happens is people pick up Lord of the Flies and they're like, oh, yes, this is about the human condition. This, oh, it's the survival of the fittest. It confirms. It's like, no, it's about a very specific group of assholes.
Yeah, and it's very much set up like that in the book. They are boys from public schools.
Yeah,
you know.
But this is the thing: is that despite the fact that that's literally why it was written as a kind of commentary on those kinds of people, that's been completely disregarded. It's just been kind of marketed as they are everybody. They represent everybody. This is what would happen to all of us. And I'm like, no, I'm almost certain that if it was a group of girls from just regular kind of backgrounds who were dropped into that situation, it would have been a very different story. Like, there probably would have still been quite a relative amount of bullshit, but for the most part, it would have been quite a different story.
Yeah, I go in two minds on that one, because after a certain point, girls are as likely to perform violence as boys are. But on the other hand, girls who haven't been conditioned in, say, a public school setting whereby you must be the best or you're nothing, or, you know, we know who our leaders are, we know who our followers are, kind of thing, would be different. Yeah. And Libba Bray has actually written a book called Beauty Queens, whereby a plane load of beauty queens for the Miss Teen America pageant crash on a desert island and are forced to find a way of surviving in a life that, you know, nothing has ever prepared them for. And it does turn out very, very differently, and I think she does it very well. So there's definitely an argument to go both ways with that one. But yeah, going back to what you were saying, picking Lord of the Flies, excellent piece of literature though it is, was probably a bit of a weird choice for a class of comprised entirely of girls.
Yeah.
And it's looking at things like Gone with the Wind by Margaret Mitchell. Yeah, that book has racism in it. It has some horrible racism, and it uses pejoratives and it uses racist slurs. You know, the racism is kind of bad enough that you miss all the casual sexism and the misogyny and the internalized misogyny between the women characters. It's still actually a sweeping epic historical story that is very well written. It's just that you can't have one without the other in that instance. I think if Gone with the Wind was written today, people would be much more sensitive about how they portrayed things.
Yeah, I quite agree.
That's not me excusing Margaret Mitchell, but I mean, she was from a very specific time and era, and they were not in the habit of necessarily questioning. That's not to say everybody was like that, but she herself clearly was not questioning as much as she should have been in that era. And someday someone will look back at us and say, well, they really weren't questioning as much as they should have been in that era. Look at all the stuff they've missed.
Absolutely.
I mean, it takes an unusual person to really question the status quo, or even notice that there's something about the status quo that really needs to be questioned.
Yeah. I mean, within our lifetime, we've already had several things questioned, including relative things which were slurs in my childhood. So, you know, about 10, 12 years ago, okay, maybe 15. I sometimes forget how old I am. but, you know, in schools, you would have had... gay would have been used as a slur, it would have been used as an insult, but you would have also had a number of other insults, like, and I'm not going to say it, but the slur pertaining to transsexual people.
Yeah.
And things like that. These were actually common use words, in that it wouldn't even be considered something which was incorrect. Now, obviously it was incorrect, but it was only when there was this kind of big vocal outcry. And, you know, things like saying someone is slow, or calling someone retarded or spastic, things like that. Which I was referred to lots and lots of times as a child because of my learning difficulties and things like that. And I never questioned it. I just thought, yeah, okay, that's just a fair thing. And then actually there was this big outcry saying, no, that's not acceptable. You can't use those words. It's not correct. And suddenly, we kind of all went, oh, right. Yes, that is. That's actually really, really terrible. A very short period of time, we gain another level of empathy and awareness, which obviously hasn't spread completely everywhere, but is you certainly don't hear that kind of language being used in quite the same way or quite the same amount as you did. So in a very short period, you kind of develop this sudden understanding, actually, no, that isn't acceptable. So in 20 years' time, I am almost certain there is going to be someone who looks back and goes, oh my God, I can't believe we did that. I can't believe we thought that that was acceptable. And that's the way things are supposed to be. That's the way progress works.
Yeah. I've got 2 points here. One is, if you go back and look at the sort of comedy that was being repeated on television, it was usually made in the 70s and it was repeated during the 80s and some of the 80s comedy. If you went back and watched some of it now, you would, I hope, be as horrified as I was when I caught some recently. And it's, yes, there is some casual racism in there, but less of it, because it's just not something that gets brought up. What's terrible is the awful endemic misogyny that is constantly in there. And the presentation of women as objects and as stupid and as decorative and as only really being there for male pleasure. And this is, you know, it's supposed to be funny. And you're sat there cringing and part of you sort of curling up inside in a protective ball, because this is just, how did this get past censors? And then you had the whole sort of Mary Whitehouse type thing whereby certain things were allowed to pass, certain things got through okay, and this sort of thing was considered fine. And yet if you had anything that mentioned, I don't know, two homosexual characters, that didn't pass the censors and could not be aired on television. So we've come, I know I'm older than Madeline, and things have come a really long way. So we're adding an extra 20 years onto Madeline's 20 years here. But it is worth, this is not a case of, oh, I'm old father time and I'm looking right back. But yeah, things have definitely changed. And a lot of it is to do with people learning to question things. It's not to say that things can't still get better. Of course they can. But it is to say, can we all just be a little bit more ready to consider other perspectives, I guess, rather than, oh my God, you said a bad word. And it's like, check, they actually know that's a bad word to start with. I mean, there are obvious ones. Both of my grandmothers, you know, when you're picking between two things and you go eeny, meeny, miny, mo.
Yes.
My grandmothers, both of them used to actually use the N-word instead of substituting it. It was only later when my parents caught them doing it. They were like, oh, you can't use that word. As a 3 or 4 year old child, I wouldn't have known what that word meant. In the same way that I didn't know what a gollywog was supposed to represent, because it didn't look like a person. It was only much, much later. Certainly through my childhood, you used to collect Robinson's Jam gollywog badges, which is terrible when you look back now, but I didn't know what they were. They just seemed like these weird little cartoon characters.
Mm.
So it's an ignorance thing, and there's no excuse for it. And obviously Robinson's Jam don't do that anymore, but you would never have looked at them and said, oh, that's supposed to be that sort of person. You'd never just have, it would have been impossible to make that connection with no frame of reference, with no context as a child. in my opinion. And I've spoken to other people from my generation. They're all like, my God, yeah, we same thing. Never made that connection until much, much later. And was then utterly horrified by it.
Yeah.
The other point I would make is that what? Not all slurs are equal, and some of them aren't actually considered slurs in the same way in different places.
Yes.
One I will bring up is, and I feel fairly confident saying this one, because usually my heat test is something comes across as a slur, and okay, if I was to swap that word with a particularly nasty racial pejorative, would I then say mm-hmm. it? In its case of, oh, no, of course I wouldn't. But some of them just don't swap like that. And I had a long conversation with Alan, who is of a Romani background. Mm-hmm. I'd had long conversations with his dad. Some of the Romani people, and particularly the I suppose the thing with the Romani is, and the Romani, this is more sort of the American side of things, there's lots of different tribes. They all speak of a common ancestor. Then there's some mythology about them being banished from India originally, but they all sort of have slightly different ways of doing things. And the more British and Irish and what have you Romani tribes don't generally consider Gypsy to be a slur. Some of them actually refer to themselves as that in preference of Romani. And I think if people say that, then you have to respect that that's the way they want to be referred to. Whereas now, whenever I see anything where the word gypsy is used in a historical context in a book, somebody jumps on it in Goodreads and says, oh, this book is terrible, it's racist. And it's a case of, actually, it wasn't always a slur word. That was actually how they kind of refer to themselves. It's actually no worse than Romani. Because the whole point was, yes, they are referring to darker skin tones. So gypsy from Egyptian, and Romani from sort of Roman, the dark Italian type caste. So that they're actually kind of equal. Those are not considered generally slurs. There are lots of others that I won't repeat that are considered far, far worse. And yet you have things like, in the last sort of 10 years, or actually maybe it was slightly before, but the first St. Trinian's film, the modern one, where the main character said, I can't go here, it's like Hogwarts for Pikeys. Pikey is a really, really bad slur for Romani people.
It is.
And yet it came out in the film. Yeah. That's actually really offensive. That's not sort of, oh God, you can't say the word gypsy. That's, oh my God, you've literally just said sort of the N-word version of gypsy.
Yeah. I mean, we used to use that word in school. And here's the thing. I did not know that's what it stood for. I just thought it meant thieves. Badly behaved people. And it was only much later that I suddenly discovered, right, no, it is referring to a particular ethnic group of people. Who are always accused of being thieves. And just, that's everything. And I think that I would have been in a lot of trouble if I had not learned that at an earlier stage. Because I might still be using it. It's kind of a funny sounding word. And there were so many jokes which revolved around the word.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, let's be honest here. The Romani people have some particularly unpleasant words for anyone who's not Romani. And that's not a case of this is our word for white people. This is our word for anyone who is not part of our tribe kind of thing. So yeah. It goes both ways. It doesn't matter what position of power you occupy. If you come up with a slur for someone who isn't you, then that is kind of a racist or ethnic slur type term. So, by the way, I'm not actually making a case for people being able to use the word gypsy. I'm just trying to point out that actually it's not considered necessarily a slur term everywhere. I know it kind of is in America, but it isn't necessarily in the rest of the world.
Yeah. I think it really, really does depend on people. And if a person says and uses that word to identify themselves, it is not your place as someone who was not part of that community to turn around saying, no, you shouldn't refer to yourself, you can't use that word. And this is going to sound crazy, but there have been instances where people are like, no, it's the same as using queer. I identify as queer, and people just say, you can't use that word, it's a slur. And I'm like, yes, I can use that word. And I'm going to use that word. And it's the same for people who decide that they want to refer to themselves as gypsies, which some of them do. There are, however, groups who will say, no, that is highly offensive. I don't want to use that term. And you respect that. But it's just about individual tribes and individual people who will use different words. And it's about their own. And it's also about understanding that older stories and things like that will use those words, particularly. You see the word gypsy come up a lot in folk songs, for instance.
Yeah.
Folk music and things like that. And it's not really a surprise when a considerable amount of that folk music will have come from, I mean, obviously we do get a lot of folk music coming from and America as well, but a lot of the sort of the English folk music will have originated within England, Scotland, Ireland or Wales, and Breton, I guess. where actually there would have been large communities of people who would have identified as gypsy. It's
worth noting that in all those folk songs, I can't think of a single one where the gypsies are presented as anything other than, if anything, they're probably slightly over-romanticised.
Yes, you do.
But they're not presented as being particularly unpleasant or unlikable. I can think of far more racist depictions in folk songs. Put it that way.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And I think actually it's also in particular because some of the music may have been coming from those tribes of people. But also, this was written by people who were kind of a little bit closer to the ground. Might have actually befriended these travelling folk.
Yeah, so, there was a huge culture in Britain, and the Romani tribes who lived in Britain, the main part of the UK, during that time, and in Ireland to an extent, would travel around the country, and there would be safe farms for them to stop at because the farmer sort of knew this particular group that went round year after year, and they'd go to Kent for the hop picking, and then they'd move on to the fruit picking, and then it was finding a berth somewhere for winter. So they weren't like universally despised and persecuted. Yes, there were some places, and they were usually the sort of farms run by great lords and things who didn't really want anything to do with them. But your independent farmer was kind of like, oh, good, the seasonal help's turned up, and they were paid for it.
Yeah. Exactly.
We've kind of lost a lot of that because obviously a lot of fruit picking and crop harvesting and things is obviously not done by hand anymore. But it, you know, that was a huge tradition in the countryside, and it wasn't always a case of you. It was two separate peoples who respected each other's way of life at its very best. A case of the Romani did not want to be settled down; they wanted to be able to travel. The farmers did not want to travel, obviously, because you can't take your fields with you. But there was space for both of them. And obviously that started to change after the Enclosure Act during the early 18th century and got worse and worse and worse until things were kind of gathered by machine. And a lot of that comes down to the fact that, yeah, maybe at that point, people who were absolutely desperate for something to eat, the fact that they couldn't common graze their animals and things anymore, perhaps they did start stealing in order to live, to survive. There was no social network to support them. So that's where this sort of myths and things come from. But the actual thing is, the actual sort of setup is centuries old. And people don't appreciate that. They just look at sort of the last 100 years and assume that's where it came from. It's been like this, and that's just not the case. And it bugs the hell out of me, I suppose, because I feel like you should do your research before you declare an opinion on something. You should really dig into it and do your research.
Yeah, absolutely.
Anyway, I've whittled on about Romani people, and I've gone off slightly. I do want to bring up I kind of want to bring up Disney because we are going to come to The Little Mermaid a bit later, but there are things where people are saying, you know, you had 71 years of Disney not representing people of colour in films, and they haven't had a princess of colour until sort of Tiana, which is fairly recent. And
yeah,
the thing is, Disney has, but they have represented people of colour in some of the most terrible and negative ways. And it's kind of like the Robinson's Jam situation, whereby until it was pointed out to me when I was an older child, I didn't realise that that was what I was being shown. And I've spoken before about how I used to love the film One of Our Dinosaurs Is Missing. And then when I watched it again as an adult recently, I was horrified by how racist it was. There was a white person impersonating a Chinese man on there and using the worst stereotypes, and it was clearly a figure of fun, and it was just so cringeworthy and embarrassing. And it's the sort of thing as a 7 or 8 year old child I wouldn't have picked up on, but now I was looking at thinking, I can't ever watch this again. This is, you know, this film's terrible because of this particular thing. And it's the same with a lot of the Disney films. If you think of Fantasia, which was brought out in 1940, so a significant amount of time ago, there's the great bit where it's all the Mozart music in the background and the female centaurs are all looking for their mates kind of thing, and they're all getting ready, and you don't really notice that one of the characters who is helping one of these female centaurs to get herself ready has the body of a mule rather than a horse, and is clearly a black character. And it's looking at it is really horrific. You suddenly go, oh my god, that's a clear message of this is where we think you belong in the social echelons.
Yeah. The whole thing about that and this mule character is that, first of all, this black character is the only black centaur. She's the help.
Yep.
She's also completely naked. She's not wearing any ornamentation at all, and she's infantized as well.
Yeah.
So there's a whole lot of very, very racist things that need to be unpacked there, which I was very, very young when it came out and I saw it for the first time, but which I didn't question, which I didn't even realize. I didn't even recognize or notice the lack of representation. And I certainly didn't go, hold on a second, that's what we get. And it is appalling, especially given the time and given the incredibly long history, which is tied with the representation of people of colour on screen.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, there are various other little bits and pieces, and we know that Walt Disney was actually kind of not a stellar guy, really, as in he was anti-Semitic at best. And I love the fact that he loves animals. Lots of people, I think Hitler loved animals, so it's kind of, nobody is just one thing, are they? But
no,
these sort of things that have filtered through and become classics, I think we need to question ourselves when we consume them. But at the same time, that doesn't mean you should necessarily throw everything out, because it's worth knowing where we've come from. It's worth knowing what the perspective was. It's just maybe Fantasia isn't one to push on children until they're much older now.
Yeah.
As an example. And then there's also the incident with the Children's Literary Prize in America. Laura Ingalls Wilder, for years, was the face of the Children's Literature Prize. She wrote the Little House on the Prairie books. And she is not kind. She's not kind. She's quite prejudiced in the way that she represents the Native American people in those books. And yeah, there was a movement sort of 2 years ago to have her removed. I mean, she died years ago, but she had to have her removed as the face of this Children's Literature Prize. And I entirely endorse that, because while I'm like, yeah, I don't think we'll burn all the Little House on the Prairie books, they do still have some value, as long as people understand that, you know, these bits are not desirable. And that's a conversation you can have with your kids. She also shouldn't be the gold standard for children's literature. It should perhaps be somebody else who is more inclusive now. You know, we've now grown out of that particular phase, and let's move forward. Well, there was massive outcry. There was massive outcry about having her removed from it. And I think, honestly, it was a step in the right direction. It was something that needed to happen. So there are changes that are definitely necessary and should happen. I just don't agree with the perspective where it's a case of, no, we shut all these books away, we never talk about them.
That, for me, trying to hide these books, trying to put them aside, trying to cancel them, burn them, basically, is actually really goes against the movement. Because I think it's important to recognise racism in the past. It's important to spot it and say, this is not acceptable. Look how far we've come. By denying it, you're basically actually denying the struggle of so many people who are underrepresented, who are also kind of ignoring the massive strides that we are capable of making. I think it's important to be able to see how far we've come. Obviously, it doesn't mean that we stop. We don't stop. We continue. But it can be very demoralizing if you don't suddenly look back and realize, actually, there was a period of history where things were drastically worse. But through action and voice and petitioning and marching and rioting, to be honest, we have made a difference.
Yeah, I'm going to say that a lot of the time, actually rioting has not actually helped. I mean, if you think of things like the end of apartheid in Africa, it could have been a bloodbath. It wasn't a bloodbath because Nelson Mandela had the wisdom to say the only way that we can move forward is if we put our anger aside. The people who did wrong need to admit what they did, and the people who were done wrong by need to be able to say calmly in what way they've been harmed. And I'm not going to say that all racism has ended in South Africa. It certainly hasn't. But it didn't turn into the bloodbath it could have done. People are justified in having anger for things. Absolutely. And I completely understand that. But it, going back to what I was saying, it cannot be a fire hose. It needs to be surgical strikes.
I guess I'm thinking of Stonewall, which is obviously what Pride is all about.
I get that.
Yeah, I understand. We're not saying go out and riot. Don't riot, actually. Rioting has been proven, usually in the past, not to actually kind of to make things worse before anything can get better. But I think it's important to recognise that these were things that did happen.
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree with that. Let's look at... In fact, before we do that, I was going to say, let's look at science fiction and fantasy and how much that's changed over the last sort of 60 years. Before we do that, I just want to say that the term white is a really selective term, and many people are sort of joining the umbrella term white. 60 years ago, the Irish were embraced and considered white, even though we are kind of some of the whitest people on earth. The Italians, again, kind of around the same sort of time. The Scots, same sort of time. So it's a case of when you're looking at history and people are using the term white, it's an umbrella term. There are obviously many, many races of white people, and some of them are I don't want to say oppressed or deprivileged necessarily, but it's not a one-size-fits-all term any more than black is or any other ethnicity. I'm not going to claim that there's no privilege to certain ethnicities, because there obviously is. But there's a desire in people for there to be a simple yes-no type negative-positive answer to things. And it's just not like that, unfortunately. Unfortunately, you have to do the work, you have to think, you have to question.
And you also have to consider different cultures.
Yeah.
Because actually, yes, certainly in America... you cannot deny white privilege. And certainly in the UK, there is white privilege. But in the UK, there is also massive movements and racism against Polish.
Yeah.
Polish people.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it was the same in America as well, but right now we're seeing a lot of it. And we're seeing a lot of racism against Polish people, Hungarian people, particularly after Brexit. Now, they are part of the white ethnicity. they have pale skin for the most part, but they are also in a vulnerable position where they are experiencing racism, experiencing attacks and slurs. If you go to different countries, you will actually find that white people are not top of the pecking order, as it were. In fact, you probably find that they're quite lower down. For instance, there are certain countries in the Middle East where absolutely being a local, being part of one of the old families, as an Arab, will get you a lot of privilege. I've seen it in action. They have license plates in Dubai which will tell you what rank you are.
Yeah.
Now, any expats who come in, so all of the white people, 5 numbers, that's the same as most as everybody else. If you are a local part of one of the families, you have 4 numbers. If you are part of the kind of associated or part of the family of the Sheikh, it's 3. If you are direct family with the Sheikh, it's 2. If you are the Sheikh himself, he drives around, his number plate has a 1 on it. Okay. And I've seen ticket collectors who are meant to be, you know, issuing fines and stuff like that, standing beside cars with 4 numbers, knowing that they cannot put a ticket on it. Because if they do, they're going to lose their job. And in fact, they might get kicked out of the country. So they stand beside it so that when waiting for the person to come back, so they can say, you're here before I could give you a ticket. Be on your way, but don't do it again. That way they won't get fired. So this is a situation where actually being white does not give you any privilege at all. In fact, kind of the opposite instead. Now, it's a very, very mixed kind of ball. There's different things going on there as well. There's certainly privilege in certain areas and no privilege in other areas. But it's about where you are. It's about conception. Not everything is based in America. Not everything is based in the UK. And saying all white people have privilege is incorrect. Not all white people have privilege. For the most part, the majority of people who have the greatest amount of privilege and access in the Western world, they do happen to be white. But it's very dangerous to just use it as a blanket term.
Yeah, I suppose that is part of the problem, is obviously an awful lot of our speculative fiction, our general fiction, our consumable culture comes from America, and people start adopting the fact that there's only the American perspective. This is not me slamming America. This is just a case of that there needs to be a little bit more cultural sharing going on so we all understand each other better, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree.
Anyway, science fiction and fantasy over the last 60 years, I'm mostly going to be talking about sexism and misogyny, but that's not to say that there weren't other prejudices involved. And it is an important thing to look at, mostly because science fiction and fantasy tends to be the genres that you expect to be more forward-looking towards the future. And yet, the sort of books that I craved, that I grew up with, ultimately did not portray women generally in a very admirable light. And I know it's something Madeline said before, where she felt very little desire to write female characters because she thought female characters were boring because what she'd been exposed to were these sort of sexy lamps and femme fatales and, you know, just these cardboard cutout characters. And there is a certain amount of it. You can certainly see with the science fiction and fantasy, the stuff that has actually endured is the stuff that was forward thinking enough at the time to try and present a more broad minded perspective.
Yeah. And I think that is really nice, is that it was forward thinking for the time. So looking back at it now, you'd be like, oh, that's not actually great. But the reason it's lasted was because it could prevail into the next generation, who it was forward thinking of the time it was written, and then it was acceptable, and that's kind of why it pushed forward. And those are very important books, even if they are outdated now, because they mark a transitional period.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was something that Alan was saying this morning. Alan sort of got on a bit of a soapbox this morning before he went off to work. But he wasn't actually wrong. And he was saying, you know, if you used to take an average large change, it used to take sort of 100 years. It's just that now the equivalent is that a large change can happen in a week. So the equivalent of 100 years would be 1,000 years of change for us. So we need to be very careful when we're saying we demand change, etc. Yeah, we should absolutely demand change, but not to get stuck in the point where we think we're waiting for something. And actually, it's kind of already happened. And we're actually pushing it back because we still have this anger, if you like, and it hasn't gone anywhere. Yeah. We haven't found a way to manage it. That is particularly noticeable in things like, I mean, let's look at rather than the last 60 years, the last 20 years of sort of fantasy. And yeah, a lot of it is when you come to things. We Madeline and I have discussed the Dresden Files before, and the fact that this is not me trying to pick on Jim Butcher, honestly. I mean, I've made my peace with them. I really enjoyed the last book of short stories, even though there was still a bit of sexism in there. I just thought it was great. I really enjoyed Briefcases. But you toted them as these really, really brilliant urban fantasy novels. And when I read them, I was horrified by the sexism. and that is just a case of what age you come to something as. And then there's things like, I'm not picking on Harry Potter actually, but it's ridiculous to expect Harry Potter to live up to the standards of representation that we now impose today, for example, because it was written 20 years ago. You can't go back and just change that. It's a case of, no, you need to accept it for what it was at the time. And at the time, it was really quite difficult to get queer characters into children's literature. It was, you know, it was almost impossible.
And I completely agree with that. I think that there's actually very little point kind of picking and poking at Harry Potter, the original series. Where I do think you should be picking and poking is at the new content, which continuously is underrepresentative and hasn't actually progressed with the times, which I think it should. And that is absolutely something you should be picking up. But I see a lot of people complaining about Harry Potter itself, and I just think, no, that's the kind of the period. It's not that it's excusable, it's just understandable. And we should absolutely point out its errors, and we should absolutely, you know, be demanding more from new content. But there's no point demanding more from something which has already been written and is published and is not going to change. There's no point getting angry about it either. You're wasting your energy getting angry about something which cannot be changed, when your anger should be taken from, okay, this has annoyed me, and I'm going to direct it for future change instead. So absolutely do point, absolutely do say, this is what we want. But don't put all of your passion and fury into wanting to change something which has already been completed and is done and dusted and finished and is part of the foundation of something which needs to improve.
Yeah.
Am I making any sense?
No, I completely agree with that. I see a lot of flame wars on Twitter, particularly in the young adult community, and we've talked about them a lot on here. And what really gets to me is when you see different own voices, authors tearing strips off each other. And it's a case of, no, we need both your voices. We need both of you. What we don't need is you at each other's throats. We don't need, you know, white bloggers coming in and making it all about them. And I see an awful lot of that happening.
And yeah. So
And, you know, the trolls and bottom feeders then get involved, and it just turns into a piece of dramatic theatre that ends up going nowhere. I would also say that technically an author doesn't owe you anything at all. They get to tell the story they want to tell. You then, as the reader, get to choose whether you read it or don't. Now, I would say as a writer, that if you don't listen to your audience, you're probably not going to stay employed as an author very long. You need to know what your audience wants, and you ought to be trying to provide it to a certain extent. But also I would say to readers, you know what, just because somebody didn't include a queer character, that doesn't mean you get to send them death and rape threats, you know?
Absolutely, yeah. I don't think it's ever acceptable to send those kinds of threats. Unless, you know, you're sending a dictator who's a literal murderer, at which point saying, we're coming for you with pitchforks as you march outside their palace, kind of fair enough. But certainly just a content creator, someone who's creating sort of general media, don't send them death threats. Don't send them rape threats either.
I mean, it's perfectly justifiable to be fed up or bored with having all your fiction having white male protagonists of a certain level of athleticism, etc., etc. It's still a narrative, though. So the writer gets to write that if they want to. Just vote with your feet. Don't read the book. Go somewhere else. You don't even have to be strident about it. You know, you can just go elsewhere, because clearly that has been written for other people who particularly want that kind of storyline. And I would honestly, quite frankly, I'm kind of bored of that myself. And I'm finding it increasingly hard to read books that have got a male protagonist unless they've done something very interesting with the character, simply because I saw so much of it through my childhood and my teens and my 20s, etc., 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 that now it's a case of, no, there's all these great new authors who are not yet discovered, writing things like, I mean, there's N.K. Jemisin, who writes some of the most beautiful fantasy imaginable. I'm in awe and jealous of her way of crafting a story. And her characters are complicated, and they're usually queer, and they are POC, and the stories are beautifully layered, and she just writes this most amazing fantasy. If she could produce around 20 books a year, I'd probably be satisfied. Which is obviously asking rather a lot. But she's not the only one, there are others. I mean, she's actually won the Hugo Award for Best Fantasy Novel 3 years in a row. So these voices, these own voices, are breaking through. And in large part, it is, as Madeline said, because people are making the right sort of noise in the right places. I get worried when I see people being strident and drowning out that right noise, the noise where you can actually hear what people are saying, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I think one of the things is that because we are now so picky about saying it has to be like this, otherwise it's wrong, which means that once again we are missing those very, very important steps toward right.
Yeah.
And so that means that there are own voice authors, there are some brilliant authors who are trying to put their thing forward, but because they've got one thing wrong, they're being shut down before they can even start.
Yeah, we must have the space to make mistakes. Authors are human, which means that something you wrote 10 years ago may have something that was a bit ableist in it when we didn't know that a term was ableist, for example.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think also the problem is that therefore, because it's even harder now for new writers to kind of to break through, because we are even more kind of strident of, no, it has to be completely right, instead the industry is dominated by these celebrity writers who are not learning and who are not changing, like J.K. Rowling. And I love the Harry Potter books. They were an intrinsic part of my childhood. I'm still very, very much part of that whole world, which so many other people are, because it was so important to us. And I am disappointed by the fact that I don't see myself represented in the books and in the new content that's coming, and that there are a ton of other people who also feel not only do they not see themselves represented, when they are represented, it's represented very, very badly. So absolutely, I'm 100% behind being really annoyed by that. But by continuing to make noise just about that, and saying, no, it has to be like this, I'm kind of ignoring all of this other amazing content, which is where all of my energy should be focused instead. I should be, because That's how you make someone else big. And when someone for doing something right, that will change the face of the industry. Harry Potter changed the face of children's fiction.
Yeah, completely.
It really, really did. So if we allow that next step to happen, rather than just expecting it to already be, you cannot expect someone who is continuously not changing to suddenly change. Let J.K. Rowling go in that respect. Turn your attention on new things instead. Let them have their time and change will happen.
Yeah, ultimately, coherence over stridency. Yeah. On that note, let's talk about The Little Mermaid. Which is one where...
People have been so annoyed!
I feel that, you know, I can completely see the perspective where you have POC people who are, you know, jubilant because finally you've got a Disney princess who is going to be... Her big problem is not going to be that she needs to get a loan, for example. Her big problem is going to be that she likes a boy who's a different species to her, which is quite a big one, actually, thinking about it. But, you know, she gets to be a bit frivolous. Why not? What doesn't every little girl at some point look at a Disney princess and think, you know, that's the kind of set of problems I want to have. I want to have those sets of qualities. And they haven't really ever seen themselves like that before. So great.
She's also a princess to start with. She comes from a position of privilege.
Yeah, absolutely.
Rather than being someone who comes from a position of non-privilege, who's had to fight her whole life.
It's completely, you know, even. But, I mean, I will admit, I have seen real silliness on both sides of this argument. The people who are kind of like, what, you can't have her like that. It's a Hans Christian Andersen fairy tale, and it would have been set in Denmark, and therefore all the characters would have been white. And it's like, well, yeah, okay, the majority might have been white, but there probably were black people there as well, let's be honest. It's just we don't talk about them in history, but they were there. They were, yeah, you know, everywhere. And also, she's a mermaid. She's a mermaid.
Yeah, she's not actually from Denmark. She's from the sea. Like Prince Eric, he's from Denmark. So I guess you could argue, all right, he's a prince, so... And he's apparently from Denmark. He's the Prince of Denmark. So, but here's the thing: even though, yeah, it was kind of set in Denmark, it's not actually set in Denmark.
No.
There is nothing which within the story which is intrinsically part of Denmark. There's nothing about the kind of the Danish culture which is prevalent within the story. Most fairy tales, it exists in its own space and time completely.
Exactly. And then you have to add in the fact that the reasons behind Hans Christian Andersen writing that fairy tale in the first place, if you want to talk about something being appropriated, shall we look at that story being taken away from the queer community and used by the straight community to tell a fairy tale? Because that's kind of what's happened and has happened in every adaptation I've ever seen.
And interestingly enough, actually, if it's not going to be about, you know, representative of the queer community, it's actually, it kind of does belong to a story about an interracial couple.
Yeah.
About how difficult that is. And how difficult that has been in history. So absolutely, it kind of does, it belongs to a minority a lot more than it belongs. It
belongs to the usual. To the default. But as you say, it belongs to a minority. I mean, I would love to see sort of a queer version of The Little Mermaid at some point in future. Disney, if you're taking a request, can we have can we have a princess and a mermaid? Maybe.
Yeah.
For the future one, when you reboot it again in 20 or 30 years' time.
Just before the license runs out, when you reboot it.
Yeah, which is ultimately kind of what that's about, but yeah, we won't talk about it. And I remember I messaged Madeline about it, and I said, quite frankly, I care far more that the actress can sing than anything else. So that was my requirement. She must be able to sing.
She must be, and I've heard her sing. She's got a really nice voice, so that's me ticked.
Yeah,
that's all I cared about. Her able to sing. There's so many people complaining about saying, oh, you know, they're deep in the sea, they should have white skin, and they're bringing up all this biology. I'm like, first of all, mermaids.
Mermaids.
Second of all, Second of all, if mermaids did exist, first of all, they'd be a lot fatter. They wouldn't have belly buttons. They wouldn't have breasts. Okay. In fact, they wouldn't have a majority. They wouldn't certainly have red hair. And in fact, when the original Little Mermaid was put forward, so many people were complaining about the fact that Ariel had red hair. Remember, this was also not that long after from a time where red hair was looked down upon because it was connected with the Irish in America. All one has to do is look at Annie, for instance, as an example of red hair being discriminated against. So actually, Ariel decisions that have come with Ariel have always kind of come with a level of discrimination attached to them. They said, no, all mermaids are blonde. First of all, be quiet. mermaids exist. They can look in whatever way they want. But actually, if you look back at a lot of the mythology, mermaids don't actually look anything like how they're shown in most original Disney movies.
No, a lot of them look surprisingly like manatees and seals and things as well. They're certainly not hot redheads. Although I admit at the time when The Little Mermaid came out, I was like, oh my god, a redheaded Disney princess. I'm like, yay! After being picked on at school and various other things. So, but I do stand by someone went on a massive, beautifully ridiculous rant about how, you know, the Little Mermaid was being taken away from the redhead community. And I'm like, hang on a minute, we have a community? I mean, it's one of those things where you kind of just get picked on it at school, or used to in my era. I don't think we're a separate race. And then someone else pointed out, you know, perhaps you could not pretend you're a separate ethnicity. Having redhead does not bestow upon you your own racial status.
Yeah, I mean, I used to get teased for having curly hair. There is a kind of a past there in terms of being against certain ethnicities who are likely to have curly hair or who are likely to have red hair or things like that. So there is a little bit of that going on. But actually, really, really important thing, okay? This is something that you have to remember, guys. When the new movie comes out, Disney are not going to come into your house and slap the old version of The Little Mermaid out of your hand and then take it and burn it. It's still going to exist. That Little Mermaid will not disappear. Just as with all of the new versions of Beauty and Aladdin, The Lion King, all of these movies which have come out or which are coming out, okay? The other day, I was walking into town and a little girl beside me had a Belle backpack. And was it Emma Watson? No, it was Belle from the original cartoon. The original cartoon, which is basically my age, okay? They're not going to disappear. Red-headed Ariel is not going to just suddenly vanish. In fact, red-headed Ariel appeared in Wreck-It Ralph 2.
Yeah.
Like, last year, was it? Was it this year? I don't even know when it came out, but it was incredibly recent. Red-headed Ariel is not going away. We're just going to have another Ariel 2.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting you said that about Belle from Beauty and the Beast, because when I was down seeing my family on last Sunday, my niece was sat on the sofa with me and she was saying, oh, have you seen Frozen? I said, yes, I've seen it twice. Uncle Alan's only seen it once because he's not a massive fan of the songs. And then then Evie was like, okay, if you've got Frozen, I might come and visit you then, which is what the whole conversation was about. And then she said, have you got Beauty and the Beast, but the cartoon Belle? Because I don't like the live Belle. I don't like the real one. Like, so there you go. You know, out of the mouths of three-year-olds, it's a case of, no, I prefer this canon, thank you very much.
Yeah, and that is going to be the way. So I do think that anyone who kind of complains about it is acting in a very, very unjustified manner. For instance, in previous weeks, we've talked about Good Omens.
Yeah.
And the fact that I wasn't very fond of Inathema from the series. I didn't like the decision for her to be American.
Yeah. It didn't fit with my headcanon either.
It didn't fit with my headcanon. I found it a little bit jarring. I did not have a huge song and dance about it, though. I just felt, I didn't really like that. I kind of wish they'd done something else. However, I'm not going to turn around to someone who says, oh, I loved that. I felt really represented. I really liked that character. I'm not going to turn around and say, sinner. Okay. But also, the case of Anathema is a little bit different. And this is really, really important. All of these people who are saying, no, she has to be white. It's a Danish fairy tale. Now, there are certain characters whose character is intrinsically tied with their ethnicity or their nationality. Yeah. And so you couldn't change it. For example, Tiana. Her story is tied with the fact that she is a black woman. Similarly.
Mulan,
yes, exactly. Mulan. She's the hero of China. Her whole story about gaining honor for and respect for herself, but identity and things like that—they're all tied in with the fact with her Chinese heritage. Okay, so you couldn't change those. In the same ballpark, Brave, Merida. Could not change Merida.
Although they made her Scottish. It's based on Maeve of Connaught, so she should be Irish technically.
Okay, but okay, so fair enough. I didn't see anyone complaining about that.
I had a little niggle to myself, but that's okay. My problem. I mean, to be fair, the Irish and the Scots share back and forth a lot of myths and legends and tell them slightly differently, so there may well have been a Scottish version as well, in fairness.
Yeah, but regardless, character within that story, within the film, it was all about, it was intrinsically tied with her Scottish heritage, or her Celtic heritage in this case.
Yeah.
Okay? So you couldn't change that. You shouldn't change that. And so all these people who say, oh, you know, all these white characters who are being changed into black, how would they feel if we changed these black characters into white characters? And I'd say, first of all, it's not actually a fair comparison because there are so few prominent black characters that actually we really don't need to take them. Second of all, we've been doing that anyway with Jesus Christ for the last 2,000 years. Yeah. Third of all, most of the stories which have black characters are actually to do with black lives, because those are the only stories that we tell. We wouldn't, you'd have casual black characters who were black, and their whole story wasn't surrounding the fact that they were black. They used to either be stereotypes, or their character was around certain hardships or realities that they had to face, which means that it wouldn't be appropriate to change them, because if you changed their ethnicity, you were actually changing a greater portion of their story and their character, which is not usually the same for white characters in films.
No, absolutely. Completely agree. And
there is literally no reason why Ariel needs to be white. Her culture literally has nothing to do with her being white. No, she's a mermaid.
She's under the sea kind of thing, you know?
But also, this is the other thing. They're like, it's a Danish fairy tale. And I'm like, yeah, and her father is what? Like, Titus or something like that?
King Triton.
Who is Greek?
Yeah, it's a little bit. I mean, maybe she's actually sort of swimming over to Denmark from Greece. We don't know.
Exactly. So you're like, okay, so she's actually Greek or from those kinds of waters? And also the whole, no, she needs to be white, fish are pale. Like, actually, some fish aren't. A lot of fish are quite dark.
Yes. Yeah, so. Absolutely. And as you say, it's the whole fairy tale thing. It sort of exists outside of the norm, as it were, anyway. So it shouldn't matter in that perspective, unless it is something that is based around a very specific ethnic, I don't want to say issue, part of an ethnicity's type culture. Life. Yeah, culture. And I would say, you know, there are certain Irish fairy tales whereby the point of the fairy tale is very much set around Irish culture from a particular time. And I wouldn't be thrilled to see somebody else co-opting that. But on the other hand, if you tell me a good story, I'll swallow it. And I have seen it done. And I'm kind of like, no, you told a good story there. I'm there for that. I saw, I've talked about Zoe Marriott before, and she did an excellent retelling of Cinderella and set it in China. It was called Shadows Across the Moon. And it's amazing. It's really, really good. But, you know, technically Cinderella belongs to France. So.
But there was a really ancient version which was in China, I think.
There was a Chinese Cinderella. It's different enough that you could say, well, it's drawing on the same tropes, but it's not the Cinderella with the glass slipper kind of thing in the same way. But yeah, she had something like 500 sisters in that one.
Mm-hmm.
In the Chinese version, apparently. So yeah, but I won't say that everybody who has complained is being racist, because some of them aren't being racist. Some of them are just being thoughtless. They're not thinking, because someone has come along and said, oh, you know, we're interrupting your beloved headcanon of the last 31 years. That just makes them silly. And you need to give them time to come round, ultimately. I mean, I'll be perfectly honest, it's a case of people need to be able to divide their headcanon from real life. That's a skill we should all really develop. For me personally, I don't have Hermione from Harry Potter as black, but I'm perfectly happy to see her played by a black actress.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And it's similarly that I am not behind Emma Watson as Belle.
No, she was okay, not, but she comes across as a bit self-righteous, I guess. But yeah, she's not your Belle, that's fair enough.
I do understand, however, because, you know, you have something which is so beloved from your childhood, and there is always a kind of a level of disappointment whenever it's kind of adapted in any way, shape or form. Particularly if it's a book and then suddenly it's a film and the act doesn't look anything like how you imagined. But when it was an animated film and then it's a live action one, there's even more pressure because you know what they look like. But what they look like isn't any way realistic if you actually kind of apply it to a real person. So already there's this great struggle there.
Yeah. I mean,
so people are always going to be disappointed.
Alan's always annoyed when we see an adaptation of a fantasy or historical thing whereby they have chosen a small, pretty man to play the lead role instead of someone who perhaps isn't quite as pretty but is the right height for the character. And he always sits there and has a bit of a grumble about, you know, you haven't picked somebody who's tall. It's understandable at 6'4" that he might feel a little bit sort of like, why are you saying constantly that I'm the wrong height? So it's an across the board thing. It's not the same as never seeing yourself represented because you're a different ethnicity, but it always amuses me.
I just remembered he was 6'4". That's hilarious, because now I'm imagining how short you are and it's even funnier.
Yeah, there are times when we playfully throw things at each other and Alan forgets that I'm nearly a foot shorter than him, and instead of hitting me in the chest, it hits me in the head. So, you know, that's always fun. And he'll go, oh my god, I'm so sorry. And I'm like, you forgot that I'm a foot shorter than you again, didn't you? Soft things, I should add. It's not a case of we chuck bricks at each other because we're bored, you know. Not quite that Captain Caveman.
Look, what you do in your spare time, Jules, is your business.
There's an ongoing joke with certain friends that, you know, we must have Klingon sex, but, you know, we're not going down that road.
Oh my god.
That's a little too much information. Sorry about that.
Anyway,
sorry.
The point is that, yeah, you're never going to get quite what you want, especially when you've already had a visual which is so prevalent in that it's right at the forefront of your mind. There's no way that it's ever going to be 100% right. And I personally think that a lot of people have liked the fact that the Disney adaptations are all sticking to the same storyline, because they want to see the same thing. They just want to see even shinier because they love this story so much. Whereas for me, I've always felt like actually an adaptation needs to do something different. And some of them, and the adaptations which are about to come out have started to do things which are a little bit different. For instance, there have been big changes to Mulan, which are based on the fact that actually they want to be more accurate to the historical period. They want to get rid of some of the harmful stereotypes and other things like that, which I think is great. That's a really, really nice improvement. And that shows that we're heading in the right direction in terms of representing other cultures in Western media in a respectful and proper way. So fantastic. Great. Thumbs up. So I think it's actually a really nice idea that we might actually have something a little bit different from this Little Mermaid.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I mean, I'm interested to see what they do with it.
And I also do think that it does change the story that's being told and perhaps takes it back to its more original roots in terms of being a story about the fact that these were two people who shouldn't be together according to law and creed and all those other kind of things, you know. Again, Hans Christian Andersen, he wrote it as a metaphor for the fact that he loved male friend, and he was saying we can't be together just as a mermaid and a human can't be together. And the nice thing about the Disney part is that actually the twist is yes, you can, happily ever after, everything
rather
turns out right for
the mermaid
best.
Turns into foam on the sea kind of thing.
So actually that's a happier thing, but what happened was that they kind of sort of took away the undercurrent of actually this was about a very difficult period in human history for queer people or for gay people. And so actually sort of having it as a black woman with a white man, considering the horrific history, which is of racism, but also the fact that that until actually fairly recently, those kinds of marriages weren't even legal in a lot of countries. You're actually bringing back some of that original, the original themes of the book, which is impossible love, whilst then having a happy ending and saying, it was supposed to be impossible, but we've proved it wrong. So that's actually kind of hopeful. I like that.
I like that. And obviously this is a huge topic and we've kind of skated over the surface, really. But I suppose that the overall message is, I don't want to just say everybody please calm down. I just want to say, could everybody focus their anger in the right sort of places? Stop fire hosing it over everything.
Remember that the things you love are not being taken from you just because new versions are coming out. Absolutely do feel free to criticise media and to point out things which are wrong. An author is consistently producing things that you don't like. Give up on that author.
Yeah,
enjoy the things that you have enjoyed of it, even if you recognise some of the errors, but look for things which are better for you and focus your energy instead of being angry on actually making that change by supporting the people who are trying to do that and who are currently unable to push through. Because there is this massive level of expectation already, which is causing authors who have great potential to do fantastic work to have their careers nipped right in the bud before they have a chance.
Yeah, absolutely. It's fine to like some problematic stuff, by the way. It's just a case of always keep your mind open and keep questioning. And on that note, I think we should wrap this episode up.
We should.
Perhaps we'll revisit The Little Mermaid and mermaids and selkies in general after the film's come out and we've both had a chance to watch it.
Yes, yes, we will. I look forward to talking about mermaids again, since I like them and Jules doesn't.
No, I'm just kind of like a bit eh about them. It's not that I don't like them, it's just a bit sort of eh. They're not my favourite mythical creature. Although I've read a lot of books about killer mermaids since then, so we could be onto something.
They're wet and slippery, says Jules. I don't like them. Oh, but the murder. The murder.
Perfect.
And suddenly
predators.
Her interest.
They take down whales. It's about pitching to
your
audience.
I have concerns. before we go, guys, it's time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation of the week. And this week, Jules has got one for us.
Yes, I've recently completed an arc of Dark Dawn by Jay Kristoff, which is the third book in the Nevernight trilogy. I think Madeline actually recommended Nevernight, the first book, a while back. This is the third one, so if you haven't read it, you can read the entire trilogy in one go once it comes out in September. It is very, very good. And it follows Mia, an assassin, as she follows, as she goes on basically a rampage to revenge her father's and mother's deaths. And I just want to say, for everybody who's kind of like, not sure about revenge arcs because sometimes they're not delivered in a very satisfying way, this is very satisfying, okay? There's a lot of blood. There's a lot of people dying. If that's what you like, you want something a bit grim, dark, with a sapphic relationship, a pansexual main character, this is excellent. Highly, highly recommend it.
Yeah, and we should point out that this is a story with an assassin who actually does kill people.
Yeah, absolutely.
Getting names. And on that note, guys, we'll say thanks very much for listening, and we'll catch you guys next week.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.